Mr. Hoffman, I'm the man you're looking for.
Is she dead?
Listen to this podcast and you'll know everything.
Even how she died.
I offer you this unique chance to listen to Now Playing Podcast's review of The Vanishing. But I'm warning you, I've taken precautions. If anything happens to me, if you aren't a Now Playing patron, my offer's no longer valid, and you won't know a thing.
What did you do to her?
I'll tell you, I promise that. But the only way to tell you is to make you listen to this bonus review podcast made only for Now Playing patrons. I've thought a lot about our meeting, Mr. Hoffman. Ever since this movie was chosen by Ulla Horvi, I felt the need to see you. You want to know what happened to Miss Saskia? Is it predestined that you listen? How can it be predestined if you won't? But I want you to know, for me, killing is not the worst thing. The worst thing is explicit language and detailed plot spoilers, and they're in this podcast.
So, she isn't dead?
Listen.
And after?
After? You'll experience what she did. It's the only way. You can leave, but then you'll never know what happened to Miss Saskia. On the other hand, listen, and you'll know. In just over an hour, I guarantee you.
I know all I need to know. I don't care about the rest. I'm leaving.
And the uncertainty? The eternal uncertainty, Mr. Hoffman? That's the worst.
Fine, I'll listen.
Then let's begin.
Today, we're discussing Vanishing, starring Bernard-Pierre Donadieu, Jean Benavides, Johanna Testig, directed by George Slouser. This is Now Playing's Golden Egg, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is the host who loves the idea of floating through space by himself forever, Jacob.
Hello, June patrons.
Welcome back. In case you thought we vanished from patron shows, we've been doing a bit of David Fincher thrillers, but we are back with our June show brought to you, chosen by one of our patrons who's here with us, Ulla.
Hi.
So why did you pick this movie?
Well, I picked this because I wanted you guys to watch something that I didn't think was necessarily just a Brown Arrow movie.
Is that because you picked The Color of Night before?
Yeah, it should be said, you have joined us before for a different kind of thriller, Bruce Willis and whatever that Color of Night was.
I think it was flesh colored in 4 inches.
It was very entertaining, but this, I agree, this is a very different experience.
I don't know, eggs floating through space, is this the gritty reboot of Mork from Ork?
So, do you like this movie? Is this, like, one of your perennial favorites, or did you just... What drew you to this movie?
Well, I sort of discovered it, I think, about a year and a half ago, when I saw a Criterion interview with Bill Hader talking about it.
That's so funny. I went to the Criterion channel, the very first thing I saw was Bill Hader interview about this movie. I'm like, I love Bill Hader, so I actually watched that interview before watching the movie this time around.
Is he a big fan?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Bill Hader, but I also just love this genre. And so I've heard some other critics talk about it, saying that it was really scary. So I wanted to check it out and became a huge fan of it. And I also just picked it for you guys to review because I wanted you to review something that I thought was genuinely good.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a pity choice. Like, oh, you poor guys. Let's do a good movie.
It's been a while. I gotta say, I appreciate the thought because, yeah, it's not too often that whether we end up, you know, raving or not about this movie is considered a cult classic. I have known about this movie for a long time. I actually saw it before there was a remake. This was like a hip movie to find after Silence of the Lambs. You know, that came out and Jeffrey Dahmer got busted. Cops were raiding his fridge. And suddenly serial killers were all the rage. And so, yeah, art houses were doing whatever they could to promote what they were showing. This little foreign film was something that was talked out a lot about in Premiere Magazine, Film Threat, the stuff that I was consuming at that time. When I knew at this point I wanted to go to film school, I knew that I wanted to find this Vanishing movie. And I did end up finding it. I think it actually played on cable. I don't even think I rented it. Sometime around 1992, maybe?
And I knew of this movie because in 94, I saw The Vanishing's American adaptation before Sandra Bullock was a star. I knew Sandra Bullock from Demolition Man. I saw she was in a movie with Kiefer Sutherland and it was about a serial killer. That's all it needed. I got a rental and I remember loving that movie. I haven't seen it since the 90s, but until just for this review, I rewatched it. But I remembered very positive feelings about Jeff Bridges and Kiefer Sutherland and barely in it, Sandra Bullock.
That is not the common experience I hear. Boy, I love that remake. Okay, we'll talk about it.
But I hadn't seen the original, but I just liked. I thought it was a little daring, a little different. A very small film. I kind of thought it really worked for what it was.
And I guess I'm the newbie because I didn't know about the remake or the original. This is my first time hearing about it. I'm just glad we're not doing the 2018 Gerard Butler, The Vanishing. I don't know what that movie is, but I've had my fill of Butler.
I wonder, was that another remake when I saw it out there? I'm like, is this a trilogy?
No, I think this has a very definite ending. I don't think you could make a sequel. Oh, well, maybe you could. I guess the killer is still alive, but we'll discuss all of that. But I do remember thinking at the time when I saw it as a high school student, I remember thinking it was very unusual. I remember feeling unsettled, but at the same time, I remember feeling like I was told this was like super scary, and there's something kind of casual about it that it wasn't Silence of the Lambs. It didn't have the extreme graphic gore. There was no cannibalism. The fact that the killer was so jovial and philosophical, I don't think I totally understood the movie. So
yes, it's very European.
Yeah, it was European at a time where I was just learning that there were other kinds of movies other than Hollywood movies. So I remember thinking it was interesting. I filed it away. I did see a little bit of that remake, but I turned that one off, not in full. And then, of course, when I found out that we were covering it, I went and watched both. I could not, however, get The Golden Egg. This is based on a novel that the going rate, when I looked at, you know, Amazon and what have you, it's about $900 to find a copy.
What?
I just couldn't cough it up.
Is there English translations of it? Isn't it a French novel?
It's Dutch, and when it was originally published in 1984, it was only in the Netherlands. I think it only got an English translation when the Hollywood version of Vanishing came out. And I guess it didn't do very well because there's not that many printings, and if you got a copy, sell, sell, sell. You're going to make a lot of money right now. But the reason why this happened at all was that the author, Tim Crabb, he had a professional career as a cyclist and as a chess player. He liked bicycles and chess.
That explains so much about this movie.
It does, actually. It feels like it comes from the mind of someone that loves the Tour de France and psychological games.
Well, that's why I keep thinking it's a French film. Yeah, because of all those bicycles. Tour de France.
Mm-hmm. He had a side hustle where he was a film journalist, and he was hanging out a lot with other Dutch filmmakers, asking them about their work. And in turn, they wanted to know what he was working on. George Slauser had already adapted one of his stories. It was called Red Desert Penitentiary. I think maybe 50 people have reviewed it on IMDb. Nobody knows it. It didn't make any money. It's some kind of strange movie within a movie farce that I guess it was a good experience for Slauser because he was like, what else you got? And he was like, well, I'm working on this thing and it's only half done. But I know that I want it to be about this couple that are cycling on vacation. They have a fight. They stop off somewhere, they seem to make up, and then the woman just vanishes. And Slauser's like, I love it. He bought the pitch, they worked on finishing it together, and I guess it wasn't a good collaboration. If I were to get a copy of that book, it's going to be a little bit different than this movie because the author didn't like where the screenplay was heading. It was always a fight about what was being revealed and when. They have the same things happen in it, but it was all about when are you going to reveal the killer? What are you going to say about what he's doing? And the author ended up walking away from the project, publishing his book, and I think Slauser really is credited with this screenplay. And he, you know, again, it couldn't have been an easy sell. Their original work together, Red Desert Penitentiary, made no money, got no critical love. This new movie has no stars in it, and Netherlands, other than Paul Verhoeven, nobody really has come out of the international film gate from the Netherlands.
So these aren't big Dutch actors.
No, they're relatively unknown. And yeah, Slauson himself is almost 60 years old. I mean, he was no young, hip director here. So this thing didn't have an audience. He finished it and nobody wanted to show it. Nobody cared. It was sort of a lucky break that the Sydney Film Festival had a last minute dropout. And they said, we got a gap in our programming. Why don't you just play whatever your stupid movie is? And it wins the audience award. The people that watched it thought it was the best thing that had been shown. And then it just took the tour of the world. And every film festival it appeared in, it walked away with statues. It got the Dutch Oscar for best film, best director. It's kind of funny how it wound up being called The Vanishing. It's really because of Stanley Kubrick. I don't think anybody wanted to see a movie called The Golden Egg, which is what the novel is based on.
It would be a harder sell.
I'd be waiting for the goose to show up.
But I did think the Swedish chef was showing up as well. Golden Egg.
It sounds delicious, but maybe not a great serial killer title. Spoorlust basically translates as traceless or without a trace. And sometimes this movie was also billed in the early days as The Man Who Needed to Know. Kind of sounds like Hitchcock, you know, The Man Who Knew Too Much. Play on that. Kubrick saw it at one of the early screenings, called up the director and said, you made the scariest movie ever made. And Slauson said, no, you made the scariest movie ever made. You made The Shining. They go back and forth and like they end up just deciding that The Vanishing, calling it The Vanishing, sounds a lot like The Shining, and that's how it should play when it reaches America. Like I said, I saw it in the early 90s. It hit art houses probably right after Silence of the Lambs won all the Oscars. Really, when people were really interested in serial killer story. And again, won a lot of praise at that time. National Board of Review called it the best film of 92, and Kubrick actually cast the actress from this movie to be in his next movie, and then decided not to make that movie. Poor girl, she filmed a lot, and then nothing ever happened of it. And yes, Hollywood's answer to this, as it always is then let's remake it. You know, we'll invite this director to Hollywood, and he can just do it all over again with Sandra Bullock, Kiefer Sutherland, and Jeff Bridges.
So that has the same director as this one?
Yeah, that's, you know, sometimes that it never seems to work out well, but sometimes that's the only way to get a green card, right? You know, Jew on The Grudge, Night Watch, Funny Games, these foreign film hits, and Hollywood doesn't want your new idea. They want you to just do what was cool, but, you know, what works in a foreign film doesn't always translate. What its foreignness itself sometimes doesn't fit into the cliches. And I think the problem really with The Vanishing, why everyone seems to hate it except Arnie, is what they do to the ending. Everyone loves the ending of this movie. They absolutely despise the happy ending that gets tagged on to the Hollywood remake. And so, yeah, I have watched both, and I'll comment about both as we go through. But we're here mostly to review this original. So Arnie, you want to give them the plot?
Rex Hoffman and his girlfriend Saskia are a Dutch couple on vacation in France. When they stop at a gas station, Saskia goes to get drinks and never returns. Rex searches for her, but finds nothing. We jump forward in time 3 years and see Rex is still searching for Saskia, though he has an uncomfortable relationship with a new girlfriend, Liniki, who is understandably off-put by Rex's obsession with his girlfriend from 3 years ago. After yet another television appearance, Rex is contacted by French chemistry professor Raymond Limorne. Through flashback, we see Raymond spent quite a bit of time planning to abduct a woman and take her to his cabin in the woods. Raymond offers Rex the opportunity to know once and for all what happened to Saskia, but to find out, Rex will have to experience what Saskia experienced. Rex comes to believe Saskia is dead, but his desire to know has Rex willingly drink a cup of drugged coffee, thus passing out as Raymond used chloroform to knock out Saskia. When Rex wakes up, he's buried alive, fated to die as Saskia did, and credits roll.
Well, as we've already, it's clear of your struggling of the names, and we've already talked about, this is a foreign film. It may not be apparent to Americans watching this, I don't think I knew when I saw it, that this couple is Dutch. And they're traveling to another country. They're actually trying to see the Tour de France. They're obviously fans of cycling because they have two bikes on the hood of their car. And they've rented a cabin where they hope to see, you know, the last leg of the tour roll by.
Yeah, later on in the film, I got that they were visiting France, as that's called out. But yeah, at first, it all sounds the same to me. Dutch, French. I'm reading those subtitles.
I'm happy to say I could tell a little bit of a difference when they would say s'il vous plaît. I knew that was not Dutch. So when they were speaking Dutch, I figured that out. And the thing is, I think this movie would be completely spoiled for somebody who understands what they're talking about with this yellow jersey. I don't know anything about the Tour de France other than that one nut Lance Armstrong won a lot.
Yeah, the only thing you know about the Tour de France is the American stuff.
Yeah.
That's about right. I mean, yep. I feel like that as the American, yeah.
So there's all this stuff about the yellow jersey. If I knew what that meant, I think that would give away a big surprise of the movie.
Yeah, you might think it might go a different way because they're driving on this highway. The first shot is of a praying mantis by a tree, pans over to see this little Dutch village, and then we get the overpass and they're headed off to France. And she's like, let's get off and see some local color. I want to like go off the main road. This usually is, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the thriller trope of, oh, you're going to see the real France and it's going to be ugly here.
A lot of snobbery and a lot of cheeses, right?
So much gas. You can't believe it. They won't even be able to ride their bikes.
And because I don't know what this movie's about, this is my first time seeing it, but it's called The Vanishing. It gives me a little hint of what's probably going to happen. And I do think, you know, talking about, is this a scary movie? I don't know if it's scary, but I do feel like there's a lot of tension because I'm waiting for someone to disappear. And they keep setting up these scenarios with Saskia. Like, she's going to talk about these dreams she has, and she's afraid to be alone and isolated by herself, floating through space in this golden egg. And then she's going to be stuck in a car as Rex just goes off. They ran out of gas. He's got to go get gas. I'm like, oh, he's going to come back and she's going to be gone. Nope, she's there. And they're going to play with that a few more times throughout where I'm like, okay, this is where she goes vanishing. Nope. So like, I do think it does a pretty good job just building that tension right from the start.
I agree, because I thought for sure my memories of the 90s film were hazy coming back to this. And when he leaves her in the beginning in the car, I'm like, oh, he's going to leave her. He's going to be racked with guilt because he left her and she vanishes here. Oh no, she vanishes there. Oh no. But man, when she's talking during this opening scene about, I had a nightmare about two eggs floating in darkness, and when they collide, I'm like, oh boy, what a heavy, heavy-handed metaphor we are starting with.
See, to me, that's just European. Is that in the American version that they dream about golden eggs?
They do not. Yeah, they remove all references to eggs.
See, okay, yeah, this is so European. I couldn't imagine Americans saying these lines.
Well, you get the sense, at least I do, that this girl is really in touch with, like, nature. Right from the get-go, she's talking about the trees, and she'll have this ritual about burying coins by a tree, and she wants to see the natural local color and all of that. I do feel like she is in touch with cosmic forces. And so that if she's having a dream, it's really a premonition. She is in tap with something that's going on in the universe. It's not just a crazy nightmare. She's up to something when she talks about eggs floating in space, which sounds absurd to me and delicious.
I mean, it does sound a little Mork from Ork, only blingy, so P. Diddy from Ork. But I mean, I knew what the end of this movie was. I knew they were getting buried alive, so I felt like the golden egg floating in nothingness is her buried alive.
Yeah, well, that's the literal meaning of this. But I also think the symbolism, what this movie is about, for me, seeing it again, it takes on deeper resonance as we go along. Yes, if you saw the movie like I did 30 years ago, you know exactly what she's talking about when she's talking about golden eggs. These are coffins. She's seeing her own death. But I do think that there's something else at work. You might also think that there's a trucker following them because, again, they're trapped in the middle of this tunnel and we see a truck, you know, go past them. Headlights kind of look like golden eggs and it honks. And later we'll see that same truck at the truck stop they wind up in. Are they being followed? Is this somebody that's out to get them? Again, if you have an American thriller sensibility, you're looking for these kinds of things and this movie is going to surprise you.
And it is really sort of high concept, you know? It's, again, going back to this, never seeing this version, but remembering the 90s version, it is a lot of, we're waiting for her to get abducted, and it's going to be playing with this expectation the whole time. You know, these two are young lovers out on a excursion, and of course, what happens when you take a road trip with someone you love? Big fight, 100% of the time.
Yeah, she was telling him, I have a dream about being abandoned. And then you just like turned around, grab a gas can and says...
And he abandons her.
I mean, he saw a gas station half a mile down the road. So in his mind, he was doing the practical thing of solving the problem. But he did leave her behind in what must have felt like a golden egg in a dark tunnel. And that must have been, again, she ends up being on the other side of that tunnel because she wasn't going to sit there and live through that. It becomes this wedge. You wonder if she didn't get abducted, what the rest of the trip would have been like. Would she have gotten over it? Would they have been able to put this behind them? They're not married.
Oh, she seems like she's over it by the time they get to the gas station getting beers and Cokes.
Yes. He ends up making a vow. Rex ends up promising, I will never, ever do that again. And they even do this ritual. I looked it up. Is this a thing in Europe? I guess it's kind of like throwing coins in a fountain.
To bury them at the base of a tree?
Yeah. You're making a wish. And, you know, it, you know, symbolizes them, of course, of like, well, this is our wish for our future. We could go back. We could turn around, go back to Amsterdam, or we could continue on with the trip as planned. But Rex says the right things. And I think he means it when he says, I loved you even more in that vulnerable moment in the tunnel. I want to continue on with you. They're not married, but notice after she disappears, he will keep calling her his wife. And he certainly treats this vow that he makes, this pledge to never let her go. It does kind of feel like that kind of marital commitment.
I didn't notice him saying his wife, and that must be right after the abduction. I noticed later on it's my friend, my friend.
Could be a translation thing, too. I don't know which version you watched it on. I saw the Criterion translation, and they used wife.
Oh, so did I. I actually subscribed to the Criterion channel for this. But
yeah.
Which one did you see, Jacob? Wife or friend?
Wife stuck out to me. That's what I have in my notes. So I must have seen wife.
But I think there's a biblical quality to this, too. If there's a tree and a man and a woman, I'm definitely thinking about
Adam and Eve.
Yes. Garden of Eden, Tree of Knowledge. This has the qualities of a parable. Certainly when you tell a story about eggs floating in space, it feels like a fable and not like real life. And so everything that I'm seeing feels demonstrative. It feels like it's done with intent, with symbolism.
Yeah, exactly. To me, this feels more like poetry, again, with all these metaphors and allusions to the Bible. And maybe, again, because it is a European film, it has more of that indie sensibility than your standard Hollywood film. It just feels more raw. So yeah, I'm willing to go with it more just because I'm not going to stick to that logic that I'd normally uphold. This is already telling me it's going to go for something more philosophical.
Jacob, I'm curious about Arnie knowing the Hollywood version, probably can guess. When we cut from them driving away from that tunnel, before they get to the truck stop, we spend a little interlude with an unnamed man putting on a sling and a fake cast and glasses and grabbing a newspaper. Did you have any inclination about how he would figure into the plot?
Oh, I figure, this was called The Vanishing, so I'm like, someone's going to get abducted, and then this woman is talking about being afraid of being lonely, so I'm like, okay, you're going to be the one abducted, and then, yeah, we see a guy setting up this ruse with a fake cast. I'm like, okay, this has got to be the kidnapper. This is the villain of the film.
And this is something that was taken from real life. I mean, it was used in Silence of the Lambs, but if you remember, Ted Bundy would put a sling on his arm and ask women for help so that he could load something into his car and then abduct them. And so here, as soon as I see a guy with a sling on his arm putting it on, I'm like, okay, run away.
Yeah, I don't think you would conclude that this was someone she knew or someone she would run away with. I think you would only assume not only is she vanishing, but she's being kidnapped.
Yeah, that is my assumption at this point.
Yeah. But we stay focused mostly on Rex because that's where the horror is. I mean, can you imagine something as forgettable as like pulling into a truck stop? How many times have we done that just to go to the bathroom, grab something to drink and head out on our way? You don't think about your time being there being meaningful. Like, he doesn't know that these are the last moments when she's buying a Frisbee and they're putting those coins away. And she just, oh, let me go back and get some drinks for the road since you're going to let me drive the rest of the way. And it ends up being, I mean, that would be very profound to have this insignificant moment be the last, you know, after you've made that promise too.
There's even some irony, like when Rex finally gets fed up and he's like, where is Saskia? He goes kick this crushed can of Coke, and we'll see a girl like grab this can of beer like right before he enters the frame, and those were the drinks. I mean, they mentioned getting those drinks, and we'll see how this plays out later, but like the very thing she went to go get that caused her vanishing is, you know, he kind of just kicks it aside as trash and doesn't take much notice of it.
I hate to be the one to tell you, Stuart, but odds are at some point that will happen. You'll be doing something completely nonchalant and somebody will die.
Also, I always find truck stops scary. Lots of strangers, especially at night. Very dirty bathrooms.
Although not this one, because again, it's bright daylight and there's so many people. You associate being abducted with like you're by yourself.
Yeah.
And here there must be 40 people milling in and out of this. And so how could anything bad happen at a truck stop at this hour of the day? I mean, I can imagine overpaying for gas. I can imagine getting in a fender bender, getting into a fight maybe, but like I just can't imagine that someone could vanish. And of course, this movie is shot in 87, 88. There are now cameras everywhere. It would be difficult to not have a record.
Yeah, that is the shocking thing when the police like start investigating. I'm like, "Oh, just look at the security footage. There is none. They didn't have those then."
We're right on the cusp of that. And so, yeah, you can literally have a large number of people coming in and out of establishment with no record of who they were.
But he had a Polaroid.
But he was just taking it of their car. I mean, he just thought, like, here I am documenting a road trip. Kids, this is what people did before Insta. You know, they would just take Instamatic photographs and that would be put it in a photo album. And that would be their vacation. Maybe it would be slides that they would punish people but making them watch it later.
And unlike Insta, it didn't remind you a year later, hey, you remember this photo? You just never looked at it again.
Yes, it just became large books in your back of your closet. But this becomes, again, he thinks he sees her in this. This becomes a significant clue, or at least an irritation of, like, that might be the moment of her disappearance that I've captured in this little square here, and why wasn't I paying better attention? And boy, what I would do to go back in time and just change one little thing, because I would, if she hadn't gone back, yeah, they would be on the road, they would be enjoying a bike ride, who knows? They would be on a different path. But we're going to leave Rex at this point. I think it's one of the arguments that the author of the book and the writer of the screenplay, this director, Slauser, was that I think Slauser always wanted Raymond to be introduced earlier and that we would know early on that she had at least been abducted.
Yeah, this feels like it's almost should be told in like chapters. Like here's our intro chapter, and now we're going to cut away to this other character and spend some time there, and then we're going to jump back in time and then jump forward. Like it does go all over the place.
Here's what I think would have been spoiled that I was referring to earlier is when we jump and we're seeing this Raymond, I kind of think I'm looking at the aftermath, and it's going to end up what I'm seeing is the prologue. So it's very, you know, Pulp Fiction-y.
Yeah, there's no title saying like 2 days ago or anything.
No.
It's just like, we're going to cut to a scene and you got to figure it out.
Yeah, again, like Tarantino would do for us. And with this, had you known more about the yellow jersey, the thing is they're talking about the yellow jersey in this Tour de France in the car when Rex and Saskia are there. And then when we start this flashback, there's talk about who's going to get the yellow jersey. I think somebody really familiar with the Tour de France would be like, this is earlier.
Yeah, I did notice all that Tour de France stuff going on, like in every scene. I'm like, is this important? Am I missing sports references that would make this deeper? Like, there's a lot of it early on in this film.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just sort of, for me, it works as heightening the tension of like, it's a lot of people worked up very much and it's soundtracking what feels like mundane things. It's giving this sense of importance to what, if you weren't watching a movie called The Vanishing, but just called Tour de France, like if this were a romantic drama, you wouldn't have that sense of ominous, something bad happening here. But because we know we're in the thriller, and because that soundtrack has screaming voices in it, it puts me more on it. But Raymond, yes, once we get to this, it becomes pretty clear that he has abducted Saskia, that we see how he has put it all together step by step. We don't know why, but we know that he's very interested in picking up sexy hitchhikers and chloroforming them and finding out how long the effects of that will take and how far he can drive.
I do love that he's like figuring out these calculations like, okay, if I use this much chloroform, they'll be knocked out for this long, which means I could travel this far. I do love how scientifically he approaches this.
And I'm just thinking he's not doing it right, though, because look at the BMI. His body mass index is much greater than the women he's trying to abduct.
Well, he is a chemist. Maybe BMI doesn't matter with chloroform. I don't know. I've never abducted anyone with it.
Yes, that's exactly what I would say. And it makes you realize, I don't think I did when I initially watched it, but you should, that this is not the MO of a killer. Like, a serial killer would not be thinking in this way. They would be coveting their victim. They would be obsessive about the type of person they wanted to get, not the means by which they would do the deed. This feels very much like a scientist that is setting up an experiment.
And there is a wry sense of humor going on. Like, he tries to pick up this one hitchhiker, and then her boyfriend pops out from behind a tree, and he's like, oh no, I can't take you. And yeah, he'll go to pick up another woman, and it's someone that knows him because their daughter's like on the same volleyball team.
I like the one where he asks a woman for help lifting the trailer, and the boyfriend comes over and is like, you need help lifting this? It's just really lightweight.
Yep. Yeah. Again, you see that, yeah, he's trying to figure out how to appeal to women. It almost feels like a pickup. And in fact, that's what they keep associating with. Like, that woman is like, if you want to have sex, go to a truck stop. She's the one that actually gives him the idea about where he can be successful with his game. Don't go to the middle of the city and start talking about women getting into your car to go to the pharmacy. Go to a truck stop and you can hook up with any woman that you want to.
It must be very different to have truck stops in France. In America, it's go to a truck stop. You can hook up with any dude that you want.
Yeah, the daughter also thinks that it's, I think that's kind of a French thing, right? Like, oh, dad's having an affair. It's okay. I'm cool with that. She comes out to visit him because he's always at their summer cottage. And she's just, you know, do you have a mistress? Like, I just feel like you're out here so often. And
like, the wife has looked at his odometer and is like, the cottage is only 37 miles away and you're driving up to 80 miles a day.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all assuming that a man could only be passionate about sex with a woman. It's inconceivable that he could be obsessed with his project. We'll find out the motives of that as it comes along. But it's easier for them to process the idea that he's just horny and middle-aged.
But when he's assuring his wife that he's not cheating on her, he gives this speech, and it's a really interesting speech. It really does hit at his motivation of, you start doing a thing, and then you just take one step, and then another, and then another. And I'm like, to me, that's not saying I'm not cheating on you. I don't even know what she thinks he's talking about. It's sure not fixing up that shithole cabin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he'll get a birthday present of, like, here's some shingles or something. I guess this is what you want. But yes, he doesn't reassure them that it's not going on. He's just sort of amused that that's all that they could think of that he would be up to. And we know, of course, that he's up to something bad. But we don't know what he's going to do with the women after he gets them. And maybe it is going to be sexual. Like, I think if you've seen enough serial killer movies, you would still assume he's going to eat her or skin her or rape her.
I mean, we see him like pulling a mattress into that summer cottage, so I'm thinking the worst.
Look at this guy. He reminded me of no one so much as King Tut, the bad guy from the Batman 66
Adam
series.
West, yeah.
With the goatee and the rotundness. I'm like, this guy is creepy. He's lucky to have a wife. So yeah, there's something untoward going on here.
Or maybe he's just French. I mean, Gerard Depardieu is considered a sex symbol, like in France. So I think that, like, culturally speaking, he would be seen as very average.
I gotta move to France.
I was thinking my father the hero when the daughter's saying, are you having an affair? It's okay. I'm like, yeah, because it's not with your daughter in this case.
Slauson did want a different actor, a more famous actor that associated with a long history of French movies, including The Conformist. And I could see that a star might have helped sell this movie better, but he ended up going with this character actor that he had worked with before. And I do want to give high praise to Bernard-Pierre Donadieu. I do feel like this movie wouldn't work if I couldn't understand this character. It's everything that we understand, that this guy is kind of average, geeky, really, almost, that he isn't seemingly doing any of the things I have seen serial killers do when they hunt women before.
Yeah, I kind of like this whole, it's just a process here. We're seeing him, you know, he is a scientist, a chemist. And so, yeah, he does a little experiment. That doesn't work. And he refines his methods. We've had that whole buildup. Like, Arnie, you call that when he tries to trick that woman to lift the trailer and the husband shows up and it's real easy. He's like, oh, okay, I gotta put a cast on. I gotta look like I'm weak and I wouldn't be able to lift that up. So I liked that we see that evolution here. It isn't just I'm a crazy serial killer. We do see someone take small step by small step into becoming something horrendous.
Although apparently on set it was a different story. Like the actress playing Saskia said she almost walked off the set because this guy was like so temperamental and weird. I guess he seemed to think that because they were unknowns, they weren't worthy of working with him. He had been in Polanski movies and, you know, he was if not a well-known actor, a working actor. And I think he was trying to push these other actors to their limits. It was not a fun shoot at all. He almost got fired, but I'm just grateful because I feel like he's kind of everything for me. I don't know that this movie would work if I didn't find Raymond so fascinating and so ordinary, so average. Again,
yeah.
That's the quality that is, I think, surprising. You hear a serial killer movie, you're like, oh, they're going to be the sickest motherfucker. What did their mother do to them? And when we'll get his story, like it becomes surprisingly philosophical.
Yeah, but before we get his story, we jump 3 years after The Vanishing and we get back to Rex and see how his life is going. And he's still obsessed with Saskia, still putting up, you know, missing posters to try to find her.
That tree motif again. We see that Her picture's on every tree. We associate her with those trees. And that's exactly where she is, by the way. She's under a tree.
And he's keeping up that vow he made. He vowed that he would never give her up. And 3 years later, he's still doing that, which means it must really suck to be his new girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. Laneke is, she describes it as a menage a trois, and that could be fun for a little while, but nobody wants, I think, to stay in that for the entire relationship. At a certain point, you want your man.
They are French.
Again, it's fun for a night, fun for a week, but it's been 8 months of this, and I think that probably, I'm just assuming, what initially drew her to this was how much he cared, the passion. Can you imagine a man that loved his girlfriend so much that 3 years later, he's still spending all of this money and doing all of this campaign to try and find her? That would be very moving. But, you know, you date it for a while and you're like, oh, God, like, are you ever going to look at me? Can I ever measure up?
It was interesting. I thought this was going to be like the remainder of the film is just like, how has it affected Rex and like destroyed his life? But that's just a small portion here. Like, we're going to get back into all that stuff with Raymond and then this whole, he's going to show up again. But I really thought, oh, maybe this is the rest of the film here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you see the American remake, it definitely spends a large amount of time with Kiefer Sutherland and Nancy Travis. And he does put it behind him. He is like, oh, you know, like, okay, I'm going to be normal. And then he's undone by the fact that the Raymond character is still reaching out to him. That's happening here. That Raymond is still sending him notes and saying, meet me at this cafe. The girlfriend is like taking pictures of everyone that's ordering food there, but we never see Raymond introducing himself. He's always watching from afar.
And we never see him like that clearly when Rex goes to that diner, like he gets up and finally leaves and we see someone. They're blurry though. They're out of focus. I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's Raymond, but you know, I can't be definitive. It's as clear as that picture Rex took earlier.
It's funny too, Rex, you know, when he was at the truck stop, his girlfriend was rolling the cigarette. He's like, I don't smoke. But because she gave him that lighter, because he's still obsessed with her, now he's a smoker. You know, like he seems very changed and not for the better. The obsessiveness of it. I mean, I really think that when he gets to that idea where he says, I'd rather be at that gas station 3 years ago than sunbathing with you. Like that says everything about his inability to like move on. Like he is trapped, stuck in that photograph. You know, like this movie is about being trapped in eggs or pictures or visuals. Predestination not giving us free will. And I think that for him, he's feeling that restraint. He's wanting to make that leap. He's wanting to find out what happened to her. And yeah, God bless him. Like, I don't know what I would do in the situation, but I really do feel for the girlfriend. It must be very painful to never be noticed.
And I think one of the things this movie has going for it, though, is Raymond and Rex are two sides of a coin. They're both obsessives. Raymond was so obsessed and so precise with his abduction, and Rex is equally obsessed with finding out what happened to Saskia. And so I think that's part of the reason why Raymond decides to pull back the veil and to toy with Rex a little and eventually out himself to Rex as he sees a kindred spirit, somebody who is as devoted to finding the woman as Raymond was devoted to making the woman disappear.
It's kind of I've never really understood it, so I'm bringing it out with trepidation, but there's that philosophical puzzle about Schrodinger's cat, right? Like,
yeah.
The cat is both alive and dead at once. It is in two states because you don't know until you open the box, and the cat can be alive or dead, but until you open the box, the cat is both alive and dead.
Yeah, if he could just let her, you know, go, and he tries it. Maybe she did meet up with somebody. Maybe there was something prearranged. Maybe she did decide she wasn't going to forgive him, or who knows what. But, like, I wish the movie had worked a little harder. I do think that the movie would be more strong if it had given a little bit more consideration to the idea that maybe she did run off with a stranger. If there had been somebody there that we would believe she'd actually prefer to be in a car with than Rex, he could entertain that idea a little bit more freely.
But I don't know that it would have played as well. Like, imagine if they hadn't made up after their fight and she disappears. Would he still be looking for her 3 years later?
If he hadn't made that vow, if she hadn't made him feel so guilty, he wouldn't be smoking. He wouldn't be, you know, hanging, going on local news, like begging. It's really pathetic, really. The extreme screaming in the middle of the night in town squares when the guy doesn't show up at the cafe is really just, yeah, someone that is undone. And it's weird, when we cut to Raymond, he is in that, it's the only time that it establishes what he does. He is a college professor of chemistry. We see that he kind of ogles the female students there, but I also get the sense that he hasn't done this again. There has not been serial killing. It was a one-off. Whatever he did to Saskia, it was an experiment, and he's not a danger anymore.
Yeah, it feels like this 3 years... it's taken him to approach Rex. Like, yeah, he hasn't been in a hurry to abduct or kill anyone else. And when he finally does reveal himself to Rex and they meet, it feels like a continuation of the experiment with Saskia. Like, okay, here's the next step.
Yeah, well, they'll even film it the same way. When he puts him in the car, it's exactly how he's rehearsed every victim that he puts into the car. And this movie starts, you start seeing that. There are a lot of callbacks. All of a sudden, there are kids playing Frisbee just like there were at the truck stop. And it gets sort of to the notion that I think this movie's really about, which is that who's controlling thing? Is it always the hand of God that is like making these things fall into line? Is it fate that damns these people, traps these people in these circumstances? Or can you step out of the unconventional, make a bold act, and have free will? I feel like that ultimately is what Raymond was testing, and ultimately what Rex has to do to find out what happened to Saskia. But Laniki, it should be said, poor girl, she gets out of there. We do have one more scene of her. She says that by her scientific rules, you get over a breakup. It takes half the time of the relationship to get over a breakup. So she'll, in 4 months, be okay. She will not be obsessive about Rex. She will not be reliving these moments once he disappears shortly after she walks out of this apartment. She is not him. And Raymond is sitting right there in the park bench. We think for a moment, at least I do, is she in danger? Is Raymond actually going to abduct her as she's leaving the apartment building? No, he has come to reveal himself to Rex and give him a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to find out what really happened.
And Rex does agree to get in that car after, what, he punches him or something. He's angry.
You gotta, yeah. I mean, come on. You're gonna get out a little bit of aggression. But this is the bind. If you kill me, you'll never know. If you turn me into the cops, you'll never know.
I mean, yeah, I do got to call BS on Rex when he's like, oh, but I got evidence. We know you touched one of those coins that you bought coffee with. Like, oh yeah, I'm sure they've kept those prints. They went through every coin in the machine.
Yeah, that's, it's for an obsessive like him, maybe that is a smoking gun, but to no one else would that hold up in court. And Rex has nothing. And more to the point, it really is about needing to know more than, like, I think he'll be okay with anything that it is. It's the not knowing that's the killer. He can't move
on. Yeah, he wants closure.
Yeah, closure is everything. And again, the guilt, you know, this is on him. He swore that he would never leave her, and that is weighing heavily. So yeah, you get in the car. I don't judge the man for getting in the car. I think I would too. I would want to know. Above all else, I value knowledge. Gets back to that biblical idea of the snake, the tree of knowledge, and that temptation. You would want to know. I couldn't walk away from it.
There's also something about male pride, I think, that comes into play is, well, she's a woman and she died, but I'll be able to get out of it.
You think that Rex doesn't think that it will kill him?
Oh, no, I definitely agree. Not till later, but yeah, at the beginning here, I think Rex believes that he's going to be able to get out of this.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And certainly, you know, they're, you know, he thinks like he sees the guy hand over his passport when they're getting to the toll booth at entry into France and all that. He's thinking, now I'm really getting those coins were one thing, but now I have the real goods on you. And once you tell me your story, yes, there'll be authorities that will be able to prosecute.
And this is where we get that story and all that stuff about fate. It all starts when Raymond was 16.
Yeah. And this is, I think, really where the director and the author also differed, was that the director, he describes himself as a defiant atheist child. And really, he identified with the idea that at a young age, you could want to do something that no one would expect. That everyone thinks about doing something crazy, but decorum, the machinery of the world, the hand of God keeps us all in a line, all doing what is expected. The only way to rebel against that is to just jump off the balcony.
Jump off a balcony?
Yeah. Yeah. My memory was wrong. I thought that he got a concussion or something, and that's what made him want to be a killer. That was my memory of that. I'm so glad it's not that. But
no, he just broke his arm, and I think that's what gave him the idea later to recreate that broken arm.
Well, we can tell I already saw different subtitles than you guys did, but the subtitles I read...
This is so weird that we all watched the same streaming service, and you got different ones.
I saw a DVD, so there may be something different to a streaming service in a physical disc.
But mine said, I broke my arm and lost two fingers. And so I'm staring at his hands. I'm like, no, he has all 10 fingers.
No fingers were lost.
No.
The fall was a holy event is what I saw him say. And that he broke his arm and he realized he was a sociopath, which to me feels like a mistranslation. Or maybe it needs clarification. It doesn't mean that he doesn't see right and wrong. It means he doesn't feel bound by it. He is the Übermensch. You know, this is getting into Nietzschean ideas of beyond good and evil. But he feels... the rules don't have to apply to him. And that's both a freeing and dangerous position to take.
I did get a real Crime and Punishment vibe off of this. Mm-hmm. And read that Dostoevsky novel, which has everything to do with that. So yeah.
And there's a Hitchcock movie, Rope, where the killers also, they make the choice to kill largely because it's an intellectual murder for them. No one can conceive of why they would do it, and that's the reason to do it. And so it's tapping into that idea of a serial killer. Very different from anything else.
Yeah, this is not Hannibal Lecter.
Right. And again, I think that was my struggle back in the early 90s, but something in middle age, as someone that has now read Dostoevsky and really likes all of that philosophical sort of ideas behind murder, it's powerful and really kind of like Rex doesn't have the patience for these stories. He's just like, tell me what happened to the girl. But I'm like, no, tell me more about your childhood. I'm loving this stuff.
I'm going with it okay. I mean, I feel like this movie had a lot of momentum in the first act. Watching him learn how to abduct was an interesting second act. Here, I feel like it's just going to a foregone conclusion, and that his opining and elevating his own deviousness to some spiritual level, when in fact he's just crazy, it gets a little long. It gets a little French.
See, to me, this feels like a chess game, not a bicycle race. These are two characters that are trying to outwit each other. One who thinks maybe he is the Übermensch. And so I don't see this as scary per se, but I feel a lot of tension throughout. And I'm on the edge of my seat as all this dialogue's coming out.
Yeah, and if you're going to just hand wave and say, oh, he's crazy and that's why he killed, I think you're really missing the point, which is the idea that he believes the only reason why he's a killer or a hero, as we get to in the next segment, the only right reason why he's anything is because he made that choice. You're not going to put him in a box. You're not going to take his picture and say, that's who you are. He's in no golden egg. He will make the leap out of that. And so what you have to ask yourself is, in this moment, did he make that jump off the balcony, or did God break his arm? And then does God give him everything that he's going to get? And does he just play out a predestination. The fascinating thing about watching the movie a second time is you realize that I'm not sure that anybody here has free will. Everyone does seem like they're traveling along in an egg, and there's nothing they can do to stop where they're going. Even this man that claims that he can do the unexplainable or the unexpected is doing exactly what the universe is telling him to do.
Yeah, we'll see him again jump off of a high ledge, this time off of a bridge, into a river to save a drowning girl, which feels like the opposite of someone being a serial killer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's, again, I don't think that he aspires to kill. He aspires to defy labels. You can call me a hero. Well, I don't play by your good and evil rules.
Yeah, he says heroes are capable of rash gestures. Like, he's telling us he's a bad guy.
Yeah, I think he intentionally leaves that doll to drown. Like, there's a yes. little girl that's drowning in the river. Okay, I'll dive off. I'll make another big leap. I'll dive in. I'll save that girl. But I know she's only drowning because she wanted to get that doll. And that doll is going to stay in that river. I'm not going to get that. I'm telling myself that I don't have to ascribe to roles of villain or hero. And that's, again, it's a dangerous position to take, that you know more than God. Usually sounds like the recipe for every Greek tragedy I've ever read.
But I also think, I guess the opposite coin, the opposite side of that coin, as Raymond is, like, Adam and Eve, like the tree of knowledge, like they got punished for eating that fruit from that tree, but he wants that knowledge. And so it feels, again, if you see that metaphor here, at this point, I'm getting a bad feeling for what's going to happen to Raymond, because it just becomes more and more obvious. Like, oh, the Adam and Eve, tree of knowledge, that wasn't it's a good thing to have knowledge, but there are consequences to that.
Yeah, we're heading back to the truck stop, but it's important to realize one other thing about, like, we see Raymond going back and trying to work his grift. And why is it successful? Ultimately, because he gets all of the gifts at his birthday. Like, they're handed to him. He doesn't conceive of how to capture these women. It's literally just like, well, here's your outfit. Here's your glasses. Here's your sweater. Here's an old scrapbook that will remind you that a broken arm makes women swoon.
Here's a keychain and a box of shingles that you can pretend are keychains that you sell.
Right, exactly. So he did none of this. All of this calculation, all of this stuff that he's trying to pull it into play, like, that was just deus ex machina.
Yeah, so maybe God wanted this to happen.
Right, exactly. And that's the struggle. It's like, that would kill him to realize, again, it's not about successfully killing anyone. It's saying that I have the choice to be, I set the rules for myself. And when I saw this movie a second time, it was remarkable to see how often things came back from the earlier truck stop and played out again, almost as if it was predestination. And they talk about that with names and how Raymond had a dog named Rex and the fact that they have the same numeral, that our keychain is going to be the reason why we actually see, you know, Saskia make the fatal choice. We go back to the truck stop and, you know, we see from his vantage point what it looked like. He was going to get another girl. He originally looked at Saskia, but like a bunch of kids came in the store and he couldn't get to her. So he's like, I'll go with the girl in the pink dress. But if only he didn't have to sneeze and chloroform him. This was some of that comedy you were talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of amusing. And yeah, I was thinking about Deus Ex Machina, about how, like, if that saved our hero, we'd all be complaining about the script.
Well, I mean, it's always difficult to talk about Deus Ex Machina in a script because scripts are engineered, so you can point to lazy screenwriting. But I think here it's the point. I do think because of the philosophical nature of this killer, the idea that he can or can't take control, that things are happening to him as opposed to him taking control, is the theme of the story. And yeah, only because he has an R keychain, and only because he took that picture on the bridge, again, that thing about being encapsulated in box, that she sees his family and thinks, oh, this guy couldn't do anything bad. That's the reason why she got in that car and agreed to be trapped in her fate. She lives out her dream or nightmare. And we see the Coke can crushed. But Rex doesn't know this. We were now at the finale, and Rex has got to decide what he can live with. He's heard a lot. He can probably surmise nothing good happened to Saskia, but he doesn't know for sure what fate she met. And the killer has even said, killing is not the worst thing. Like, that's not what I conceived. I wanted to do the worst thing possible. It wasn't the killing. He's a claustrophobic. The worst thing in the world would be trapped, confined, and unable to get out. That's the worst thing I could imagine happening, is being boxed in. And that's why he did what he does. And if you notice, too, more biblical allusions. When you look at those pumps, some beautiful shots in this. They all look like crucifixes at this time. It's a real neat trick of the cinematographer and the art director. But when Rex is standing there, it's got a real Jesus quality as he's debating his fate.
Yeah, and I think this is, again, a very tense scene where, hey, if you want to find out the fate of Saskia, you got to go through what she went through. You got to drink this drugged coffee. And you're going to get knocked out, and then you're going to know. You're going to know. You're going to wake up and know what happened to her. And again, we see this whole struggle with Rex. But again, I don't know if scary is the right word, but it's definitely a tense situation that I would never want to be in. I could see why people would say this is a scary movie. It's not a fun situation.
It's ominous for certain. I mean, scary implies that we're seeing something graphic, or seeing something that we are like, oh, you know, like something's going to pop out, jump scares. You know, we know the patterns of a thriller, and it's not really emulated. Those, but it's the portent. It's the fact that we ourselves feel like we're hurtling towards a tragic end that we can't get out of the way from, which is why the idea of the Hollywood movie giving this a happy ending is so irritating. It has to end.
I can't wait to hear about this happy ending it got.
Well, but we're almost there, because we are at the climax of this film. But I think in the end, am I wrong? He goes back to the tree, and because the coins are still there, he thinks that she's still alive.
That's like a sign.
Yeah, this is the superstition telling me she's waiting for me. She's at the end of that tunnel. She's alive. Somehow, beyond all my rational beliefs, I'm going to be reunited with her in some way. And I guess he is? I don't know. It's, you know, depending on your spiritual leanings.
He's going to know what her fate was.
Yeah. I mean, and maybe they are together, like her dream. Their eggs, you know, floating nearby. I don't, sounds like hell and not heaven, but...
I took it as those eggs in space were forever separated, but floating in darkness.
Yeah. And I think you know, they're not together. Like, she died years before. And, you know, he wakes up. Yeah, it's you know, always being buried alive is a tense moment. But, like, the fact that we see the toe poking out of his sock and, you know, he kind of is there with that lighter that she gave him, you know, and it's dying. I feel like all of the metaphors and the symbolisms and all are just... It feels kind of like the perfect ending. Like I can't imagine any other way this story would have wound up.
Americans could think of another way for it to end up, though.
Yeah, I'm going to say there's another way.
But if the symbolism is about solipsism, you know, that the idea, if you accept the idea that it's impossible to know anything or to have control over anything, which is the big theme of this movie, we're born and we die in our coffins. This really visualizes that terror very well.
And it just made me think, now it's finally time for me to watch that Ryan Reynolds movie, Buried. It's a sequel, right?
You can skip that one, my opinion. But we get the praying mantis again. We get one more shot of Raymond. I don't know. Is it a success for him? He doesn't look happy. I mean, he gets away with it. He's at his summer cottage.
Oh, to me, he looks satisfied that, like, he pulled it all off.
That's how I took his expression. Was satisfaction. He won. I mean, he won a physical battle against a woman and a mental battle against a man.
I did not see satisfaction on his face. Maybe it's just that he's with his wife that he obviously has disdain for. She's watering the burial plots without realizing it. But I get the sense that maybe he realizes that he didn't. Like, it was all... I don't know. I don't know if he's come to the conclusion that I have, that, in fact, he did nothing on his own. That it all sort of followed a path that was started long before him and continues after he's made his leap. But, you know, the final shot, the memorable one, they got to literalize the egg thing. We see this tracking shot away from him to the trailer hitch, up to the car where there's a newspaper reporting on the fact that Rex has also gone missing. And their captions are two little egg-shaped pictures. Kind of cheesy, kind of creepy.
Yeah,
kind of.
It kind of works and overstates itself at the same time.
Well, let's not overstate ourselves. Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Vanishing? Jacob.
I didn't have a whole lot of problems. Even though with that cheesy ending where they both literally end up in eggs. I think my biggest problem with this film was the score. Not that it was necessarily bad, but it had such a natural feel to the film. Like, it just felt like filming real people and dialogue at times. And then all of a sudden you get some synths or accordions or electric guitar at one point. I'm like, it feels like that was added to try to make this feel like more of a traditional thriller. So the score, it's interesting. I didn't feel like it fit at times. But other than that, look, I love Russian literature, and you get British literature, it's all about class. American literature, it's all about the individual. Russian literature was always philosophical. I love Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, all the classics with Russian literature. And so I really enjoyed this one, getting into this debate of fate and how much in control are we. And yeah, I go with this film because I like the poetry of it. I like the metaphor. If you take this more literally, I could see you having a lot of problems with it, like this weird chemistry teacher, like calculating how long chloroform might knock you out. It might seem a little weird, but I really enjoyed the debate that this film is getting into about, you know, even again, I don't like it when films make it look like getting knowledge is a bad thing. That happens a lot of times, and more than I like in films, where it's like, oh, you get knowledge, but you're punished for it.
Now they're hitting you where it hurts. That's why it gets you, right? Is that you don't want to believe that's true.
I don't, but I also know it is true. Like, we have atom bombs which do horrible destruction and lots of deaths because we sought knowledge. Like, that is a part of getting knowledge. So, I think this film does a really good job at getting at these philosophical ideas and having that debate. I like that it feels like a European film or an indie American film. Like, those kind of go hand in hand. It's not a Hollywood film. I like the rawness to it. I think that really helps sell this story about this weird chemistry teacher serial killer and all these debates they're going to have. So yeah, strong recommend for The Vanishing. I'm glad this one was brought to my attention. I really enjoyed it.
Stuart.
Yeah, I was really surprised coming back because my memory was it was one of those, you know, they call it a pot boiler. Like, once you know the ending, the water boils over and there's nothing left in the pot. And you go, well, I don't need to see that again because I know, they end up in the coffin. That's what it's all about. What big whoop. Coming back to it middle-aged, having gone to college in between reading Dostoevsky, the philosophical underpinnings are really what are haunting, you know, about this movie. I do think, yeah, if you're looking for serial killer thrills and chase scenes and what have you, this movie's way too mundane. You know, it doesn't have the fetishistic love for murder, you know, like the way that I think a lot of serial killer movies like Seven would. This is a movie that takes the stance that we are all, you know, trapped in our tombs and, you know, who we choose to love, what we know about them, how much we can act upon our own lives are very limited. We're all trapped. It's a claustrophobic existence. If you find those ideas scary, and boy do I, if those haunt your dreams, this movie will take you somewhere deep. I really do think that it unnerves me in ways that few movies do. And I also really want to compliment the actor that played Raymond. It's a very difficult part to nail. It's one that Jeff Bridges completely fails at. It's another reason why the remake is bad. You have to have the right Raymond in order for these ideas to come through. If I didn't understand this man and see that he wasn't a sadist, like, it's important to see that it wasn't important to kill. It was important to defy. I see that in that performance. He's humanized. I end up feeling just as bad for him as I do for Saskia and Rex. This is a very high recommend, but think of it as a bottle of wine. You gotta let it breathe. It's probably gonna take a while for you to really appreciate it. Refine palate, savor the understated flavors. I think you may not have a strong reaction upon first viewing, but it stays with you. It won't vanish.
And I think maybe the three of us saw three different but three good movies here, because I don't get into all of the philosophical Dostoevsky type of thing, and I come to this looking at, you know, is it a good suspenseful thriller, you know, not a serial killer movie by any means, but a thriller. And I did remember the American version, so I knew a lot of what was going to happen. Surprisingly, I actually forgot the happy ending of the American version. I thought that ended with Kiefer Sutherland in a box.
Well, he goes there, but he gets out of it, yes.
Yeah, I forgot that little detail. So I thought this movie would have a very nihilistic ending. So watching it and kind of being spoiled, the question was, could I enjoy it as much the second time going around? And it was my first time seeing the original version, but the two hew very close together in many respects as far as the storyline goes. And yes, I actually still enjoy it quite a bit. I do credit the performances, even though I do think Raymond, I can't laud him as much as you did, Stuart. I think he just comes off cheeky and a little bit comedic, and maybe that's what you like about it. For me,
mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not a sadist. He's not cheeky in the sense that, oh, I really love killing that woman. I think that's a very unusual thing for a, I would keep calling him a serial killer, but he's a one-off killer. It's a weird thing to see a killer that doesn't enjoy his work.
The fact that that was the killer, I thought the American version did that a little bit better.
Have you seen it again?
Yes, I went back and rewatched.
Okay, all right, we'll talk about it in a minute then. All right.
But I do enjoy this movie. It's a really solid recommend, and I thank you, Ula, for bringing us to it to watch and to give me a chance to see the original, which when I saw the remake, the original was not something available for me to watch. I'd read in a magazine that it was a remake, but I didn't have a way to get the original, and now I got a chance to watch it, and it was fun to revisit this thriller from the 90s. I think if you want it on a philosophical level, the arguments you two made are very compelling. If you want just a good thriller movie, though, this one is great. I saw it as a film about obsession, two men's different obsession with a woman, neither of which are actually a healthy obsession, you know? Even at the end, I don't think Rex was out of love for Saskia. It was more about the pursuit. We find that out when he takes the drink. He's convinced Saskia's dead, still wants to know. His obsession wasn't with the girl, it was with the knowledge, and so was Raymond's.
Yeah, that's the horror of it for me, is that he never did even know her or know her enough to love her. It was, they were in two different eggs. Yeah, he was all by himself. It's creepy to me.
So yeah, it is a definite recommend from me, though. I enjoyed this one, and having revisited the American one, it is the better of the two adaptations.
Thank God. Okay, I'm so glad we don't have to have that fight. But what does Ula think?
Yeah, I'm very happy you all enjoyed the movie. For me, my enjoyment comes from kind of a combination of everything you have mentioned. The reason why I think it's kind of scary is because it has that sort of like raw European atmosphere to it. And I also really enjoy Raymond's sort of philosophical justification of what he is doing. So for me, it's like one of my favorite movies. And I think it's because I got a little bit of all the positive stuff that you guys said.
Great. Yeah, I agree. It gets better the more you see it. I would have just assumed it was one of those kind of simple, it's all about the end twist. But yeah, this movie, it stays with you. It is haunting. And I think it is because of that ending. I mean, you changed the ending.
Yeah, come on. Tell me what happens in this American ending.
You want to talk about a vanishing. Can anyone find a copy of this American version?
I could, and I wanted to see it when I found out there was a remake, but I couldn't find it.
I tried to find one legally. I always try to find one legally. I had to go to illegal places because that was the only way to find it, which is shocking because Kiefer Sutherland, Jeff Bridges, Sandra Bullock, I mean, that's names, and it was a main release 90s film.
20th Century Fox. Yeah. it should, because this ending. So here's what it is. I will say this. Jacob, like, for the most part, they're not that dissimilar. There's a lot more with Kiefer and the new girl. But what's really funny is Nancy Travis was a bigger star than Sandra Bullock. So you're supposed to want to see him wind up with that girl and get over Sandra Bullock, where, of course.
Yeah, the So I Married an Axe Murderer girl is so much better.
But at the time, that's what we believed. Who knew? But problem number one, and I love Jeff Bridges. I think he's great at about everything. But he makes a vocal choice. His killer, Barney, talks in this really, I don't know what it is, but it just sounds like an Elmer Fudd kind of stupid voice. And I don't know if it's meant to make him seem unassuming and jovial, like I saw this character, but he's not scary in any way. He's very silly. And then they don't want to go with the idea that everyone is trapped in a box. You can get out of that box. Your girlfriend will dig you out.
Wait, is that what happened? The girlfriend doesn't even die?
No. Sandra Bullock dies, but Nancy Travis saves Kiefer.
Wow.
Yes. Like, imagine Leminky coming in at the end of this and, like, digging him out and then, like, getting in fist fights and really stupid Hollywood stuff. But the worst part of it is, like, the last shot is, like, them going to a publisher and it's the end of the meal and the waiter brings the coffee and they're like, we don't do coffee anymore. Ha, 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 ha. And, like, they...
Oh, I thought you said they're going to bring, like, hard-boiled eggs out and she's going to freak out.
No. There's no reference to the golden eggs at all. It was all about the drug coffee. And yeah, Nancy Travis turns it all into a Senka ad. I was just like, I don't get why you would want to end a thriller with this goofy coffee joke. You wouldn't believe it was the same director. That was the shock, is that Slauser did it to him. himself. He took a cool movie and then turned it into something really unhip.
Also, to drive home, the American version is 100% chronological. Mm-hmm. The movie opens with Jeff Bridges practicing the abductions. There is zero question about it. There's none of this. We learn it in the middle. Our first character we're introduced to is the Raymond character. And yeah, I have a problem getting Jeff Bridges and Jeff Daniels confused. And when you throw that voice in, I'm like, this is the Dumb and Dumber guy, right?
Dumb and Dumber prequel.
Yeah, you know, I don't see them as looking very similar, but you're right, that voice. Mm-hmm.
I actually had to look it up. I'm like, is this Flynn or is this Lloyd?
No, it's an excellent point you made about the non-chronological. That is a part of the experience. You take that guessing game away and you make it chronological and it becomes far less interesting. Bad choices all around. I saw nothing that got improved in Coming to America at all.
I liked Kiefer better. I'll say that much.
Okay, I'll give you, I didn't really like the actor playing Rex. By the way, the director, Slauser, didn't really like him. He was only hired because I guess he could speak both languages and they had a limited budget. And this is, all the other actors were only French or Dutch. So being bilingual got a marginal actor his only notable film role. But I don't think this is what cost the director his career. He would have had another Hollywood thriller. He was in production with Dark Blood. And the problem was it was starring River Phoenix,
uh-oh,
who in the middle of shooting has his OD, and they couldn't film the rest of the movie and just scrapped it. And so that really had to hurt, knowing that he had an expensive half-made movie that apparently he did before he died. Slauser did go back and I think he animated scenes that didn't get filmed, like half the movie's animated or something. But if you're really curious, it's out there. You can see, I guess it's River Phoenix living in the shadow of nuclear testing, like, you know, out there in the Arizona desert, some kind of thriller involving another couple on traveling on vacation again. It sounds like it's similar to Vanishing, but an incomplete vision. We'll never know if it's as good. And then he made one other, you know, I can tell you this one wasn't good. He made one more Hollywood film in which Stephen Baldwin is an actor playing an uncaught serial killer, and Pete Postlethwaite is the killer, mad because he's being played by Stephen Baldwin, who wouldn't be mad about that, and goes to try to kill him. It's one of those dumb movies that there were a dozen of in the 90s, where, you know, like, art and the exploitive nature of news media and what have you, and it was a flop. And then he had that half-made film, and then no one liked the Vanishing remake, and Slauser just went back to the Netherlands and continued his career out there. I've never seen any of his other films, but I'd be curious to. Vanishing, if that was the only thing good he ever made, he made a really good film. And maybe we'll get a really good film next month. I have not seen Con Air.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be very similar themes to The Vanishing.
I imagine. Yeah,
really big philosophical debate on fate and the prison industrial complex. You're in for a real treat.
Ula, you like Color of Night, you like The Vanishing. Where do you stand on Con Air?
I love Con Air, so I'm very excited for that.
See, I told you, Stuart, it's very similar to this. I can't wait for you to watch it.
And I don't know why, but we're having a very special release. It is coming out on Wednesday, July 14th, because that's somehow important to this movie. So
I don't remember that reference from the film.
Yeah, I don't. But you guys will hear our thoughts on it Wednesday, July 14th. That will be the July patron show. So hope you can join us for that. And if you want more Missing Girls, we got them starting next week. We're going back to the original, 2009. This one is going to be in Swedish, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. We're going to cover that original trilogy before we get to the Fincher version.
Now playing. We've got all the women abduction you need.
Apparently, it's very dark this June.
All these dark foreign films.
Yep. Which is, I guess, what it'll be the nicest way that I can experience Fast and the Furious 9. It'll just be a nice break from all of this gloom and existentialism.
So, Ula, thank you for picking this movie for us. I had a great conversation and glad you were able to join us on the show for it.
And staying up, I just want to point out this man is like, it's like 4:30 in the morning, a time difference.
Yeah, closer to Amsterdam than we are.
Yeah.
But maybe he's getting that experience of what it's like to be trapped in the box with the lighter.
I know you are.
So, Ula, Jacob Stewart, thank you for joining us. And now it's time for us to vanish.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign. and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast. Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all. The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated. Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended. Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2021, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Vandag bespreken, we will read met de horrorful.
Whoa. Wow.
Horrorful. Bernard Pierre.
Jeez, Google Translate for this?
Yes, I did.
Just have it read it for you.
Arnie has been replaced by the Swedish chef.
Vandaag bespreken we verdwijnen met in de hoofdrol. Vandaag bespreken we verdwijnen met in de hoofdrol.
Vandaag bespreken we verdwijnen.
All right, no. Really?
Did you practice this? Did you,
yeah.
No, to see how it would go?
Mm-mm.
Or is this a cold read?
What happened was I called up the wiki page and saw it was called Sporloos. And I decided, oh, that would be fun to say today we're discussing Sporloos. But that makes no sense. So now I need to know how to say today we're discussing in Dutch. Bridges. It is Bridges, not Daniels, right?
Yeah. Jacob, yeah. Yes, Jeff Bridges.
Bridges.
When Rex wakes up, he's buried alive, fated to die as Sandra died, and credits roll.
Saskia
died? Saskia, not Sandra Bullock.
It is Sandra Bullock, but yes.
Did I say Sandra?
He said
you
Sandra,
did say
yeah.
Sandra. We could call her Sandy. If it might make this recording go easy if we just call him Sandy and Rex.
Can we just use the American names? Kiefer's looking for Sandy, and we have Jeff. Same movie, but just use American names. Rex wakes up, and he's buried alive.